Hello and welcome to the Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Today, some amazing findings which suggest that aging is not necessarily a one-way street.
Why on earth is it even possible to rejuvenate an old tissue? In terms of the old brain, what is it about an old brain that's still there that you can actually tap into to make it look younger? We thought that aging was aging and it was final, and apparently it's not. It's plastic.
In a new twist to the vampire fad, could it be that young blood is the elixir of youth? The differences between men and women and their risk of Alzheimer's disease, and remarkable findings from the Queensland Brain Institute, where they've applied ultrasound to the heads of mice who have a form of Alzheimer's disease and found that the sound waves clear the stuff called amyloid, which is thought to be gumming up thinking and memory. Jürgen Gütz is director of the Centre for Ageing Dementia Research at the Queensland Brain Institute, which is also where Gerhard Leininger works, doing his doctorate. Jürgen Gütz.
There has been some prior work using ultrasound as a surgical instrument, for example, to destroy brain tumors and also as a means to target the thalamus to treat Parkinson's disease.
Really, the thalamus being one of the control centers in the brain.
Exactly. So it was a bit exploratory. We just hoped it would work, and surprisingly it worked remarkably well.
So Gerhard, tell me about the experiment.
In our lab, we use transgenic mice, which means they've been genetically engineered to have the same mutations that in a human would cause them to develop Alzheimer's disease. So they also develop the plaques inside the brain, which are made of amyloid beta. And inside the brain, there's a similar sort of toxic environment that you would see in an Alzheimer's disease patient.
So that's the model, is mice with, an artificially created genetic form of Alzheimer's disease. Mm-hmm. And tell me about the ultrasound. What sort of ultrasound did you use?
This is a particular type of ultrasound called focused therapeutic ultrasound. Ultrasound is a general term for any sort of acoustic energy or sound waves that can pass through tissue. There are many different types of ultrasound, and I used ultrasound of a particular frequency and a particular type of pressure so that I could get an effect I wanted on the brain.
So this isn't like the sort of ultrasound that would look at your baby when you're pregnant or scan your hand for a tendon injury?
No, it's a different type of ultrasound. We're applying the ultrasound energy, but in a diagnostic setting, you apply the ultrasound energy and then you wait to hear an echo. We're not waiting to hear that echo for use as a diagnostic. What we're doing is applying that energy to the tissue to have an effect.
So are you bathing the brain, or are you running one of those sensors around the brain?
It's very much like that second option. So because the ultrasound is narrowly focused, it works on a particular spot at a time. I'm moving a sensor around in three dimensions to cover the whole brain of the mouse.
So rather than a helmet, it's the active thing. And is it like there's a machine called a lithotripter to break up kidney stones that are stuck? Is it like a lithotripter, which is a bit like a shotgun-focused sound wave?
That would be another type of therapeutic ultrasound. So it's similar in that both of those are therapeutic rather than diagnostic ultrasound devices. But here I'm using an intensity of the energy which would be much lower than you would use to break up kidney stones.
So you're not banging the brain around?
No, I'm not banging the brain around. The brain's very sensitive, and what I found is that the cells inside the brain are very sensitive to this treatment, and that can lead to improved pathology.
I'm talking to Gerhard Leininger and Jürgen Gütz from the Queensland Brain Institute about some fascinating research on ultrasound to clear the brain of plaques, the rubbish that builds up in the dementing brain. And so, Jürgen, what results did you get?
The results are actually very impressive. I mean, we were able, with 6 to 8 treatments over 6 to 8 weeks, to remove 50% of the amyloid and to restore memory functions in 3 independent memory tests.
So these were not just mice with the plaques. These were mice whose thinking and memory, as much as you can test that in mice, was stuffed up.
Exactly. And we were able to restore, with just a few treatments, we were able to restore memory functions to what you would find in normal mice, in wild-type mice, which don't develop Alzheimer's disease.
Now, you get nothing for nothing in this world. If you've shaken up the brain enough to break up the amyloid, you could have done damage at the same time.
That is something which we tested. So very carefully we analyzed the brain using histology, and we have no evidence for any damage at all.
What happened to the amyloid? I mean, does it just sit there in little particles, or does it get mopped up? What happens to it?
We originally thought that the amyloid would be cleared from the brain and that you would be able to pick it up in the blood. So we did tests to determine whether amyloid would be cleared out of the brain, and there was no evidence for that. So what we found was that
And just before you go on, before what you found, the risk there is that the amyloid deposits in places like the heart and causes heart failure and things like that.
Not in our mouse model, no. And we don't have any evidence that the amyloid would be cleared into the bloodstream.
The other risk, Gerhard, is that you stimulate cell growth in the brain and risk brain cancer. Did you look for that?
I did a lot of structural studies in the brain to see whether the neurons looked healthy and what the structure of the brain was like, and I didn't see any changes at all to the structure of the brain.
So not even the supporting cells that are the cause of brain cancer, the glial cells?
The changes that we saw were in a type of immune cell in the brain. So these are the microglial cells. Normally in the brain, the microglial cells can change depending on the environment they're in, and this is how an immune system in the brain works. And we think that this is impaired in Alzheimer's disease. What we found is that we could increase the response of these microglial cells. What they did is that they ate more of the amyloid beta, so they took it up within them. We found double the amount of amyloid beta within these cells after the ultrasound.
So that's where the amyloid was going. Mm. Now, this could have been nothing to do with amyloid clearance, because there's a debate amongst the dementia community about whether amyloid is the cause of dementia or just a side effect, and that the other protein which is involved, which I'll come to in a moment, tau, is the real problem.
We are working both on tau and amyloid. But, for example, when you think of PET scans, one finds that the presence of amyloid is an excellent predictor of developing dementia.
Did you try the whole brain versus certain areas, or it was just generalized brain? It's too early to say whether just focusing it on one spot in the brain would work.
That's an excellent question. We actually started just picking a few spots, and then we realized that you have to scan the entire brain.
Which goes along with Alzheimer's disease being a whole-of-brain disease.
Exactly, because in Alzheimer's disease, one has a very widespread distribution of amyloid plaques.
Gerhard, how long did it take for the amyloid to grow back?
That's another experiment that we have planned that we haven't looked at yet. But we know that the production rates of amyloid beta in these mice is quite different to what you would have in humans, where the amount of amyloid beta builds up over many years or even decades.
These were mice with genetic form, what we would call presenile dementia, where you get dementia early in life, which is a different disease from Alzheimer's that you get when you're in your 80s and 90s. How applicable do you think this is to common or garden Alzheimer's disease?
We are convinced that it is applicable because, again, when you look at the brain, the damage which you find in a patient with familial Alzheimer's disease is very similar to what you find in a patient with sporadic Alzheimer's disease. Both brains are characterized by amyloid deposition.
So Jürgen, what do you need to do next to, because everybody's going to say, well, when can I get this? You know, turn up my local ultrasound clinic for some brain scanning. So first of all, do the devices exist in the general medical market? And what would you have to do next before you studied it in humans?
We have initiated a collaboration with a professor at the Queensland University of Technology, and the next step will be to move into larger animals. We will be developing a device which allows us to achieve something similar, hopefully, in sheep.
So not ready for showtime yet?
No, unfortunately not.
Well, mouse brains are much smaller than a human brain, so what we want to do is scale up and treat a larger brain.
If you can get the sound waves to penetrate deep enough.
Exactly.
Yes.
Was there any effect on this other protein that people think is important in Alzheimer's disease, tau, which causes what are called tangles rather than plaques when you look down the microscope?
Obviously, we have started with an animal model which only reproduces the amyloid pathology of Alzheimer's disease. But we have started experiments in a separate set of mice that develop a tau pathology. And so we have to wait a few months until we see whether this approach would also work in mice with a tau deposition.
Well, good luck with it. Fascinating research. Thanks very much to you both.
Thank you.
Jürgen Gütz and Gerhard Leiniger are in the Queensland Brain Institute. And you're with the Health Report here on RN with me, Norman Swan. Another way of rejuvenating the ageing brain may one day be a transfusion of goodies from a young person's blood. Research at the University of California, San Francisco has found that young blood can reverse the effects of ageing on the brain. The lab chief is Saul Villeda.
It's actually based on about 10 years worth of research.
I'm about to go cover this in the next 10 minutes.
Exactly. The procedure we use, the parabiosis surgical procedure, that was actually first described in 1864. So it's a really, really old technique. But about 10 years ago...
So what is the technique?
Literally connecting together two animals. such that two hearts are pumping one bloodstream. It's the best way to combine young blood with old blood and start asking questions about, you know, is old blood bad? Is young blood good? And really start looking at the different organs.
Because you'd imagine that would kill the animal, because if you did it to humans, it would kill them unless they had compatible blood.
So we're using a little trick that we use in science in that, you know, we have inbred strains. Basically, you know, these mice have been bred so that they're almost little clones of each other. So no rejection occurs. Of course, in humans, that would not be possible, which is why we study animal models. But what that allows us to do is exactly mix, you know, sort of young and old animals together.
What did they use it for in the 19th century?
Oh, you should check out some of those papers. I don't want to give anyone any idea.
Secret science business. Yeah. And where did the idea about young blood versus old blood? Because blood circulates. You know, your blood cells last for 120 days. Your white blood cells last for a variable length of time, but much longer than that. Because you don't always imagine the blood is always kind of young.
So the very first time this procedure was used for the idea of aging, I believe, was in the 1970s. And then it went dormant. People didn't really use the technique anymore. Then in the early 2000s, it got used again for stem cells to really show one cell from one animal can make cells in another animal. Therefore, there are stem cells. And then at Stanford, the lab of Dr. Tom Rando was the first one that started looking at the effects of young blood on stem cells in muscle. And they showed that young blood could rejuvenate stem cell activity in muscle and injury. I was then in the lab of Dr. Tony Weisskopf at Stanford, and we were collaborating with them. I then started using the model to ask questions about the brain. We started first with stem cells in the brain, and then, you know, more recently, things like cognition. So again, in the surgery, it's great to look at cellular changes, stem cell changes, neuronal changes, but you can't really do cognition on two animals that are basically Siamese twins of each other. So we came up with another approach, which was just plasma administration. So our hypothesis was that it was actually factors in blood that were doing something. And that's what we did. We took away the cells and just kept the factors, the plasma.
For people who have only got a vague idea of what blood actually is, blood has cells, white blood cells and red blood cells, and then it's got the liquid around it, kind of a soup, which is the plasma, which has got all sorts of goodies in it.
Exactly. I usually describe it as the juice. So, you know, we took that, all the factors, and then injected it into, you know, previously in 2011, we took old blood and put it into young animal and showed you can make it, you know, age a little bit at a cognitive level. And then this...
So if you give blood from an old animal to another animal, it will age them a bit.
It's detrimental. Yeah. Cognitively, the stem cells decrease in the brain. So there's something that is accumulating in old blood that is promoting aging. And then the experiment we did now is we took young blood, young plasma, put it into an old animal. It turns out you can reverse some of the impairments that are normally there. And I did that originally at Stanford, and then I started my own lab here at UCSF, and my students then did it here as well. So we've seen that in multiple labs. But yeah, something about young blood can actually take the effects of aging, because these animals are old, they're normal, they have impairments, and somehow you can sort of turn back a little bit the hands of time, just a little bit. You turn back the clock in that those impairments are much, much better.
So what does it actually do to the brain? What are the changes that you see?
Yeah, so one of my graduate students here is really interested in that. We took microarray analysis. So we looked at all the genetic changes that are happening in the brain, genes that go up and go down. And then through some analysis, we saw that there was one potential sort of master regulator that looked really interesting called Krebs. And Krebs actually an old friend to neuroscientists, and that we know it's involved in things like learning and memory during development. So we thought, okay, why don't we see whether this is involved? What he did is he actually made viruses that you could infect neurons in the brain and it would block this master regulator. It wouldn't get rid of it, it would just block it. So what happened is when you give the young blood, normally you see cognitive enhancements. But when you block this master regulator and then give young blood, you actually block a lot of the really good effects. So it seems like something in young blood is acting like a switch. So normally this master regulator is turned off with aging. Somehow young blood is turning it back on. And that's causing all these changes in, you know, in the cells, the molecular changes, structural changes, and then eventually cognitive changes.
At the cellular level, without getting too complicated, what do you see?
As we get older, most people think that the neurons die. They actually don't. They die in disease. But during normal aging, their communication gets impaired. And the way that that happens is where two neurons contact each other, it's a synapse. And you can actually visualize the point of contact. They're called little spines. They look like little protrusions, like thorns on a rose. So those are where the connections are. As we get older, we start losing them and they become less dynamic. So it turns out what blood is doing is it's allowing those connections to be maintained and even bringing some of them back. So it's strengthening the way in which the neurons are talking to each other. That seems to be promoting these effects.
And what about nerve growth, which is another hot area of research as we get older? It used to be thought that the number of nerves we have in the brain is fixed, but it's now known that you can regenerate nerves.
Yeah, that's the second thing that this is actually doing, is it's stimulating more neurons to be born. And we saw this, and now also groups at Harvard saw the same thing. Young blood can stimulate stem cell activity in different areas of the brain.
And what about the behavior of the animals? I mean, it's hard to give them a cognitive test saying, do you remember, you know, who the prime minister is?
Yeah, there's certain hallmarks of aging. And, you know, it's funny because every species has cognitive impairments with age, from little worms all the way up to humans. One type of memory that is impaired with aging in both humans and mice is known as spatial learning and memory. I like to think about it in terms of finding your car in a parking lot. So I'm here at UCSF.
Now you're worrying me.
So I'm here and I park my car every morning and I have a beautiful view of Golden Gate Bridge, and usually I'm a little lazy, so I try and find the elevator, and there's always an electric car charger here. We're very green. So I try and park there. My brain's going to make a note of these cues: Golden Gate Bridge, elevator, electric car charger. I go work for however many hours, come back at night, and my brain's going to see those cues and guide me to the car. And I can do that because I'm still young. As we get older, we start having a harder time with that. So our brain is not going to be able to take us back to the car as well. And then you see people with their car alarms trying to find it based on that rather than the visual cues. Same thing happens to a mouse. You put in a pool of water. There's a hidden platform. They hate water. And then you put cues around the pool. So just like my Golden Gate and the elevator, maybe I'll put a checkerboard and a heart, maybe black and white. And the animal's going to learn, okay, my platform is here with respect to those spatial cues. A young animal, very good. An old animal can never get as good as a young. It always has a hard time orienting and remembering where it is. So we use these types of tests to model some of the impairments we see in humans.
Have you been able to find anything in the young blood yet that seems to be a candidate factor for switching this on and off?
My lab has not, and of course we're pursuing that. The labs from Harvard have actually found one, GDF11, and they've shown that it improves heart and it improves muscle and it improves stem cell function. No one's ever tested this particular factor in behavior, and I think it's going to be a combination of factors. So I think, you know, we're probably going to have to decrease some pro-aging factors that are accumulating, because we know old blood is also detrimental, and maybe it's going to be a cocktail of young factors. So I think it's really important for all these labs to continue trying to find these factors, because it may be a combination of them.
Is there a threshold where young blood becomes old blood?
Good question. We've done proteomic screens.
These are the proteins, the substances that are produced by genes.
Exactly. So we've looked at changes, and there's definitely inflammatory-related changes that occur between 12 to 18 months. That seems to be sort of this window of change that's happening.
That's mouse middle age.
Mouse.
Yeah, so that's definitely mouse middle age. A young mouse, we consider about 3 months. That's in their 20s. So the experiments we did was using young blood. That's about equivalent to someone in their 20s. The old to us, we used about 18 months to someone in their 60s. So when we're talking about 12 to 18, we're talking, you know, someone probably in their 40s, that sort of range would be where we're starting to see a shift, an inflammatory shift in sort of the composition in the blood. And we think that's probably the age at which it may be too late to use it for a beneficial effect, but not old enough that it's detrimental.
Is there a risk in this that you induce cancer?
All great questions. So far, all the studies that have been done have waited about a month to look at the benefits. Ongoing studies are still happening in terms of waiting to see how long lasting the effects are, as well as if we do a chronic treatment over a long time, does it have any detrimental effects? So as of now, we don't have the answers to that yet. So far, everyone that's looked at the model and looked at different tissues doesn't see any detrimental effects, but we're still looking at these sorts of questions.
And it has implications, if it's all true, it has implications for the blood transfusion service.
Yeah, so I tell people, don't worry about it. You know, in terms of blood banks, they pull together blood from multiple donors.
Covering yourself here.
Absolutely. So, you know, you're not getting it from, you know, a really old person or a young person. So I'm not worried about it, of course.
So where to from here? Obviously, people are desperate to commercialize this and find the key factor for reversing aging.
I definitely think one of the focuses throughout all of the labs that are doing this is to find additional factors. Like I said, I think it'll be, you know, most likely a cocktail will have the most robust effect. What my lab's really interested in is also asking the question, why on earth is it even possible to rejuvenate an old tissue? In terms of the old brain, what is it about an old brain that's still there that you can actually tap into to make it look younger? We thought that aging was aging and it was final, and apparently it's not. It's plastic. So we're really interested in understanding that.
Well, of course, I mean, they've shown that intense exercise can simulate some of the effects that you found.
Exactly. You know, and they've shown things in stem cells, they've shown things in neurons. So all of it collectively argues aging isn't as final as we thought. There's some malleability, there's some plasticity. And now our lab is really interested in just understanding why. You know, what cells are plastic and what's the minimal amount of plasticity that you need to elicit things like cognitive rejuvenation? Do you need the immune cells? Do you need the stem cells? Do you need all of them? Do you meet some of them. So those are the types of questions we're really interested in.
You see vampires and young people disappearing all over the world.
That was definitely one of the concerns that my mother stressed when I was getting my PhD. I told her, don't worry, that won't happen.
You're not going to be sold into slavery. Thanks very much, Saul.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Saul Villeda, who's at the University of California, San Francisco. There are a few things that are known to increase your chances of Alzheimer's disease at a given age, apart from a strong family history. They include head injuries, fewer years of education, smoking, diabetes, and other coronary risk factors. And there's having one or two copies of a gene related to how we deal with cholesterol. It's called APOE4, and research at Stanford University in California has found and confirmed indeed that this gene may affect women's risk of Alzheimer's more than men. Michael Gracius is medical director of the Stanford Center for Memory Disorders in Palo Alto.
APOE is a protein that's important for shuttling cholesterol between cells. But in Alzheimer's disease, we think it's important for that same role in the brain. In the brain, cholesterol is really important for maintaining the integrity of cell boundaries and membranes, for example. And so if cells are damaged and they need to be repaired, there's a lot of cholesterol shuttling that takes place.
And what's the problem with the APOE4? So it comes in different colors, if you like, this gene, and there's an APOE4, which everybody thinks is related to Alzheimer's disease. What's the difference between it and the common or garden APOE genes?
There's a change in one of the nucleotides that... One of the letters of the code. And we think the protein still functions, but it doesn't function as well as it should. And we think that APOE, the normal protein, is really important for processing amyloid, one of the proteins in Alzheimer's disease.
And without making the listeners totally cross-eyed, you get one version of the APOE gene from your mother and one from your father. So in other words, you can get a half dose or a full dose to have the effect.
That's right. Yeah, you can have one or two copies of this APOE4 risk gene.
And how much does the double dose of APOE4 increase your risk?
It varies a little bit across different estimates. Some people say as high as, you know, 9 or 10 fold if you live to be 90 or so.
Hold that thought about APOE4 while we go to another focus of Michael Gracius's research into the decline in thinking and memory as we age and the drift into Alzheimer's. He and his team believe that it's possible to see the signs of early brain changes in a scan of the brain at rest called resting functional magnetic resonance imaging, or resting state fMRI. So now let's bring that scan and the gene together.
Right, so we were interested in how far we could push this brain imaging candidate test for Alzheimer's disease. And the typical way to do this is to ask if it's abnormal in Alzheimer's, is it also abnormal in preclinical stages of the disease? So mild cognitive impairment is a preclinical sort of stage of Alzheimer's disease. And
this is a kind of a stage of forgetfulness. Some of these people go into Alzheimer's disease and some don't.
Yeah, that's right. They're forgetful, but they can still kind of run the show on their own. They can still often work and handle their finances and all that, but they're at a very high risk for progression of Alzheimer's over the next 3 or 4 years. And then the next step was to look at healthy older subjects that carry one or two copies of this APOE4 risk gene for Alzheimer's. And I happened upon this old, what's called a meta-analysis, which is sort of an averaging of different genetic studies on APOE. And this was from 97 across several thousand subjects, look at where there are differential effects of the APOE4 risk gene in men compared to women. And they found this sizable effect in that if you carry just one copy of this APOE4 risk gene and you're a man, you don't actually bump your risk up for Alzheimer's very much at all. But if you're a woman and you have one copy of the APOE4 gene, your risk bumps up about fourfold compared to women without the gene. And this was something, you know, had been around since 1997. It was strangely very rarely cited. I had been seeing patients for, you know, 10 years before I even happened upon this and had always assumed that men and women had equal risk. And so that's what we decided to do, to look at this resting state functional connectivity approach and ask, do we see expected Alzheimer's-like changes in women, that healthy women that carry the APOE4 gene, more so than in healthy men that carry the APOE4 gene? And that's what we found.
So what could it be in women that's giving them this increased risk?
That's sort of the $64,000 question. There are a number of possibilities. One big one that we're trying to pursue now is that it turns out that the front of the APOE gene has what's called an estrogen response element.
Good theory, but older women don't have much estrogen around.
Well, so that's the issue, right? Maybe prior to menopause, when there's a lot of estrogen around, women are making a lot of APOE. And if you have a deficient APOE4 gene or two of them, you might be able to overcome the deficits if you just overproduce the protein. And this is a hypothesis, of course. Then at menopause, when estrogen levels plummet, this hypothetical compensatory.
It unleashes the gene.
Or it prevents women from correcting it by overproducing the gene.
So you've tried to now bring this to the clinic. In other words, what's the relevance for the average person, and can you actually use this usefully in a clinical setting?
Right. So I am a neurologist by training, and I see patients all day Friday, and, I suffer all the frustrations, albeit at a, less intense level that my patients and their families do, and that we don't really have any treatment for this really horrible illness. And so our first approach to this was to look at clinical conversion risk.
By clinical conversion risk, you mean what?
So there are a few large publicly available databases of large populations of healthy older controls, and they're followed longitudinally. So they're evaluated typically every year. And so you can look at people, say, in their 70s who start out as healthy controls, and over 4 or 5 years have they converted to mild cognitive impairment or to Alzheimer's disease. And similarly, some subjects that start with mild cognitive impairment, you can look at their conversion risk over time to Alzheimer's disease.
And what did you find?
We found in both cases, again, a pretty sizable interaction. Even with a single copy of the E4 gene, men and women both have an increased risk of converting either from healthy aging to MCI or from MCI to Alzheimer's disease. But in essentially all cases, no matter how we looked at it, whether with, one or two copies of the gene or just one copy of the gene, that risk was always greater in women. So, for example, if you start with healthy aging and you're a man with an APOE4 gene, your increased risk is about 1.2-fold. So it's significant in these large sample sizes, but not that impressive. Whereas if you're a woman, your risk bumps up about 1.8-fold, so almost 2-fold increased risk if you carry an APOE4 gene.
So what do you do with this information?
First of all, this sort of shored up this finding for us. This is, the first longitudinal study to look at this interaction. So this really, for me, made me much more confident about this interaction and suggests very strongly if there's something important and biological about this that might help us, not only think about conversion risk, but possible treatments that might differ between men and women, or clues to treatments that we might do well to look at a little more closely in women, but that could help men and women both, for example.
Because this goes to the issue, people listening to this think, oh my God, should I have my APOE4 tested and know what my status is?
No is the answer to that question at this point, in particular because
you've only got a Friday free for your clinic.
Yeah, right. Well, so this has been a problem locally and probably elsewhere too with this direct-to-consumer genetic testing. This was a big problem here in the Bay Area where a company called 23andMe was providing what was supposed to be sort of fun genetic information on your ancestry and your earwax and all these sort of trivial things. But one of the options that people didn't really understand very well was that APOE genotyping was also made available here, and there was sort of an opt-out tick box that a lot of people kind of overlooked. So I've had already a handful of completely healthy people that pursued this direct-to-consumer testing for other reasons that found out that they have one or, in a couple cases, two copies of the APOE4 gene, and they're faced with this question, what do I do now, right? So the answer to your question, should people go out and get tested, in my view, is very strongly no. Particularly if you don't have any symptoms. If you do have symptoms, you should consult with a physician and decide whether that APOE genotyping is going to be useful for you.
But when I was in medical school, we were taught, don't have a test done unless it's going to change the treatment.
Right. Very sage counsel and counsel that we still abide by. I would broaden it a little bit and say, unless it's going to affect your management. We have to be a little more generous in our notion of how we treat Alzheimer's patients, because some people want as much information as they can in terms of predicting their long-term risk, getting some window on how long they might be expected to live if they develop Alzheimer's disease and what the risk is. So in the right setting, I think even in the absence of a definitive treatment for Alzheimer's disease, APOE genotyping information can be informative, but it really is a case-by-case basis and needs to be decided between a patient and their physician, I think.
Michael Gracius is medical director of the Stanford Center for Memory Disorders in Palo Alto. I'm Norman Swan, and this has been the Health Report. I'll see you next week.